You're listening to Not Many of You Should Become Teachers, a podcast that explores the world of K-12 education as it intersects with the Christian faith. You might call us extreme moderates. We're skeptics who try not to be cynics, who desire to see Christian educators dive deeper in their vocation. Welcome to the show.
David Smith,
the
godfather of this podcast. I think I used that phrase.
It's pretty amazing that we were able to, last year we were able to visit David's conference in Michigan, and just at the beginning of the summer, we took his course at Regent College, and then now we got to sit down virtually and chat with David and discuss Christian education when he really is like an A-lister in this conversation when it comes to finding the connection between faith and learning. He's a real, he thinks hard about these things. It doesn't just stop at worldview or XYZ. He's a deep thinker.
When you and I were debriefing a little bit of the course that we took with him at Regent, and one of the things, I don't know who to attribute this to, either you or me, one of us mentioned it's a helpful and a healthy critique of some of the landscape of Christian education and how we think and act within it. And I wouldn't go so far as to say it's oppositional, but it's subtle and it's subversive, right?
Like
he does have he has an agenda, but it's done, I think, with some of the best of intentions, and it is heartfelt.
Yeah, there is that mild subversion there, but the best part is that it ends in substance, right? And I think people will, when they listen to our episode, will recognize that it's not throwing out the baby with the bathwater at all. That metaphor is completely wrong, actually. It's just really trying to, if our beliefs truly, and he'll talk about this being the core question, but if our beliefs truly form what it is that we do, who we are and what we do, teaching should be one of those things. And what is that supposed to look like aside from a head-heavy vision statement or vision for what you say education should be, and more about what's actually taking place.
You got it. And it was just a very rich conversation. We got to rehash in one sense, but sort of relive some of the highlight moments from the course, right? And some of the things that we've learned, and just bounce it off of him, and then really bring it down to, it's not that we have to bring David down to practical levels, because I think within his deep thoughtfulness, it's always with the classroom teacher in mind, right? Tactile, practical, hands-on thing that we are doing when we intervene in the lives of students.
Yeah, so as podcasters here, it really is an honor to reiterate a lot of David's thoughts. So to the listeners out there, we hope that you thoroughly enjoy our interview with Dr. David I. Smith. Okay, here we are with a new episode of Not Many of You Should Become Teachers. We are honored to be with a new guest here, someone that Dave and I have engaged with, his writings and lots of stuff that he's been doing. So we're very thankful to have Dr. David I. Smith with us today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We thought maybe that we could start with a bit of an introduction. So how about you let our audience know a little bit about who you are, where you're located, and what you do?
I'm a teacher, have been for decades now. I started out teaching in K-12 as a language teacher, teaching German, French, and Russian in Britain, if you can't tell from the accent. And then about 20 years ago, I moved to Grand Rapids, Michigan, to what was then Calvin College, now Calvin University, initially as a professor of German. And about 6 or 7 years ago, I think, I moved over to become a full-time professor of education at Calvin. And I also direct a thing there called the Kaiser Institute for Christian Teaching and Learning, which is a research institute focused on what it says, what Christian has to do with teaching and learning.
Wonderful. So yeah, David, thank you so much for your time today. And both Riley and I have we've joked a little bit that much of the vision for this podcast and our conversations have been shaped by both Kyer's and your work, and so we're really grateful for that. And we were actually at the conference pre-COVID and all of that, and grateful mm-hmm. that our school was able to send us to the Shaping Christian Learning Conference last year, and just so much learning there. So this might sound incredibly broad, but we'd love our listeners to hear directly from you. What does Christian faith have to do with learning?
That is incredibly broad, because of course Christian Christian faith is incredibly broad, and learning can mean like everything from like, you know, kindergarten kids sort of having bathroom training through to graduate physics classes through to, you know, and obviously education's different in different countries and so on. So I think part of what I want to keep insisting on is that there isn't like a quick formula that tells you what Christian education is. Christianity itself is it includes beliefs, practices, the heart as well as the mind, patterns of community and relationship, and so on. And of course, education includes a whole range of different things. So, mm-hmm. The question is really this constant thing of is teaching here? This is, I think, the core question: is teaching kind of like going to the dentist or getting your car engine fixed, where you should be able to you take your car to the mechanic and you don't really care whether your mechanic's a Christian or a Buddhist mm-hmm. or a Hindu or what they are, because as long as they know which bit goes where and they put all the bolts back in, then it should work, right? It should drive off the lot, and you hope they're honest, right? And they're not ripping you off or something, but right. But outside of that, like it doesn't really seem like their basic beliefs about the world have this massive impact on how they go about the task. So is teaching like that? Is it like a technical activity where if we could just do enough research and get it right, it would go? Or is teaching more like, let's say, parenting, where it does actually seem to matter what kind of vision for human existence you have? And people who grow up in different families grow up in different ways, right? Have quite different experiences of what a family is. And that partly goes back to people's convictions, to whether people are Christian or Muslim or Jewish or whatever they are. So I think what I'm interested in is sort of that second part, which is once we realize that teaching, you can't walk into a classroom or into an online space without some kind of idea of what a learner is, of how they're supposed to function, how they're supposed to grow, how are they supposed to change as a result of being in this learning experience. And some kind of conception of what it is you're going to teach. What's important enough about the world that you actually chose to include it in this little segment of time mm-hmm. where you didn't include everything. You made choices. You're telling a story about the world. It's not a photograph. It's a story because you're always selecting. That you can't do that without committing yourself in some way, right? Without having some kind of big story about why this matters. Why teach this rather than this? Why ask the students to do this rather than that? So, I find it hard to talk about this for very long without diving into examples. So here's one that I just used this morning with a group of faculty. A number of years back, I was at a parent-teacher conference for my kids at a high school. And I talked to two science teachers, one right after the other. And the first one pulled out his grade book, and he opened it up, and he ran his finger down the list of names. And he got to my son's name, and then he literally read out all the scores one by one on every assignment he had for the semester. Like, he got a 9 on the first one, then a 9.5, and it, you know, took him about a minute. And he got to the end, and he said he got a 94% on the semester. Great semester's work. And he sat back and smiled at me as if he'd said something intelligent. And so we sort of concluded that conversation, and I walked 8 feet, and I sat down with another science teacher. And again, introduced ourselves, found out which kid was mine. And he sat back in his chair and he said, you know, I've really appreciated having your son in my physics class, because where he sits in the classroom, there's another student sits right behind him that has some learning disabilities. And we have these long blocked science classes. And this other student has trouble staying on track, just easily loses the plot of the class. And he said, I've noticed your son choosing sensitive moments to just turn around and make sure this other student knows what's happening and keep him included in the lesson. And he said, I really appreciated that because one of the things I've been emphasizing to my students this semester is that we're a Christian learning community. That means you're not just here for your grade. You're not just here for your success. You're not just here so that you can learn physics. You're here for the well-being of the person on your left and on your right and in front of you and behind you. And you need to take responsibility for them. And I've seen your son responding to that. So I went away from that thinking, you know, his two teachers, both quite possibly equally competent at explaining science or setting up experiments, but they've got different visions of what's included in the act of teaching. And I sort of wonder how many physics teachers in North America might see it, might realize that it could be part of their responsibility to teach the nature of interdependent community. And yet it's not that one teacher is doing something value laden and the other teacher isn't, because they're both teaching implicit messages about community. One's just doing it more overtly and more intentionally than the other one, because both of them are going into classrooms and influencing how students interact with each other and whether they think learning is just about themselves or whether they think it's about other people. You can't not do something in that direction. But you're going to have to interrupt me because you've got me on topics. I'm just going to keep going if you, yes, if you sort of ask me a good question and hit go. So
that's what we sort of figured. And the one aspect I was thinking there in our context here in British Columbia, there's a lot of talk about how we're all, like, every educator is a literacy educator, every educator is a numeracy educator. And I'm hearing in what you're saying too, that I mean, really implicitly or explicitly, we're all pushing or promoting or living within a values system, right? In our teaching. So very good.
Mm-hmm. This idea that what we believe and who we are impacts what we do, like in the examples that you were giving, like, not like this, the teacher A, the one that just kind of went through the scores, like you said, like, may have like a value system or a vision, but it just doesn't result in what you sometimes call an ankle level pedagogical move or something that's happening a lot closer to the surface that we saw in the second example. So as we kind of in that same vein, you talk a lot about linking these Christian visions or Christian imagination. It's been fascinating to learn about imagination in connection to pedagogy. And I'm just curious if you could maybe unpack what this imagination means and why it's so central to your vision to connecting faith and learning.
Yeah, it's tricky. I don't think there's one right way of talking about this. I think we're all kind of groping for language to get at something whole here, because we've kind of been through various phases historically, especially in faith-based schools, right? There's been a time when there was a real focus on doctrine and beliefs, right? And you know, that's obviously important, right? Christianity has some doctrines, but that can keep you focused on the Christian part of education, just being the moments where you're actually talking about, you know, the incarnation or justification or whatever, and sort of not direct your attention to all of the everyday stuff that's going on, like how you seat people in the physics class. So then in some quarters, there was this move to talking about worldview, right? That's Christianity is not just a set of theological beliefs, it's a worldview. And you know, my own institution is very invested in that kind of language, and it's a useful language in lots of ways. But it can keep you focused on Christianity as a set of intellectual perspectives, like here's my Christian view of evolutionary psychology, here's my Christian view of literature, here's my Christian view of. And it was interesting in some research we did a couple of years ago, we got a book just out called Digital Life Together. We spent a number of years studying how faith-based schools were using technology. And it was fascinating to me how in our surveys and focus groups, the teachers who were very invested in worldview language tended to think about the faith part of teaching with technology as critiquing the worldview of the ideas that students found on websites. The content, right? Does the content have a Christian worldview?
Yes.
Whereas teachers who thought in terms of Christian practices, for instance, were more likely to think about, well, should I be asking my students to fast from using their phone? Or, you know, we're thinking about actual technology practices. So I think that there's something about the worldview language that can tempt you to think that the Christian part of education is mostly kind of ideology critique. And that's an important, you know, that's an important exercise. But I'm looking for languages that free up a bit more of the space and say, no, there's still other things to think about. So imagination is one way of doing that, because I think one of the things that Christian faith offers, that scripture offers, is ways of imagining the world. So if you read through, I've just been reading through the last part of Isaiah, right? And all these images in Isaiah are about, you know, the fasting that God's chosen and liberating the oppressed, and you'll be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail, right? Mm-hmm. None of those phrases, it's like Martin Luther King language, right? Those phrases don't tell you exactly what to do, but they do give you this space to live in that's resonant with themes of nourishment and refreshment and justice and well-being and so on. So
I love that. It's a space. It's a vision of a vista, right? So
yeah. Whereas I think a lot of contemporary education invites you to live in an imaginative space, which is mostly bureaucratic. So it's focused on objectives and outcomes and measurables and countables and so on. And I think that's often a very different imaginative space. And it's not that those things don't matter, but I wonder what happens if we actually have the courage to let the imaginative space that faith opens, that scripture opens, inform the way we imagine teaching and learning.
Mm. Hearing this language of imagination and sort of vision, and then the practices, like that is sounding very similar. Some of the stuff that we've picked up from Jamie Smith, right, with that whole tradition of thinking through, we're more than just cerebral intellectual creatures. We're being formed. So,
we're actually secretly clones. That's why we have the same second name.
Yeah. Have you done work with him at all on any of this type of stuff?
Yeah, definitely directly. In fact, we in 2011 we had a book out together called Teaching and Christian Practices.
Right. Yes. Okay.
Where we tried to take both some of the work he was doing in Desiring the Kingdom and Imagining the Kingdom on this notion of bodily formation, right, and bodily practices and desire that he was pulling out of Augustine and some of the stuff I was doing in pedagogy and so on. And we pulled a team of people together and basically asked the question. Again, it's back to this thing about trying to stretch the boundaries of worldview talk, right? What if instead of starting from a list of Christian beliefs, you started from a list of Christian practices? So Christian practices would include things like intentional community, forgiveness, justice seeking, prayer, worship, you know, and so on, right? There are longer lists. And then asked yourself, if I were to reconstruct one of my classes around enacting a Christian practice, and what I think that helps us get at is I had a conversation with a student a couple of years ago. I'm getting old enough that could mean any time in the last decade. But sometime recently, I talked to a student who said, she said, I took a course, and the first day of class, the professor said to us, "We're a Christian learning community. That means each individual here in this class is important and has something to bring because God's gifted each of you. And that means it's important for you to come to class and participate because each of you matters." And she said, "I hadn't heard somebody begin class that way before. It was kind of inspiring. I thought it was quite beautiful." And then she paused and she said, "You know, it took me 2 or 3 weeks to figure out it wasn't really true. Because in fact, the way the class was taught, it made zero difference whether I showed up or not to anything that happened, you know, my own input or perspectives or whatever made no difference. So in the end, it was just beautiful talk." So I think that was the kind of thing we were trying to start to get at in that book was how do you stop the Christian bit from just being beautiful talk that makes you feel all righteous and faithy because you're using these Christian words and you do devotions at the start of class and maybe you even tell a bit of a Christian story and so on, and it makes you feel like you're on the side of the angels. But what practices are actually constructing the learning in your class, and do they resonate with Christian practices? Because if they don't, you're going to get a plausibility gap that's going to invite cynicism about the Christian
language.
And
that is the space that I'm in the high school, teach secondary level, and Riley does middle school, and we've had alumni, like former students, come onto this very podcast and talk about that and sort of that, some of that gap. And it's really easy to shed or just chuck away that language if you don't even find it that beautiful, right? Or you don't find it that compelling, and it doesn't really align with what was being experienced or practiced in the classroom. So that actually leads into, you use the word plausibility. And one of the things that stuck out to me, and Riley and I were talking about this when we spent the week together online at the beginning of this summer through Regent College, was this idea of being economical. I think you mentioned that in our in use of explicitly Christian language or vocabulary. And how does that connect to the idea of it being plausible? Maybe could you just unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, goodness, there's lots of directions we could tease that in. There is an economics to language. So, you know, language that gets overexposed tends to get devalued and just becomes wallpaper, right? Becomes background. So, you know, I live in a city that has a very large number of churches and they've, a lot of them have got billboards outside them with cute sayings and Bible verses and so on. And I always kind of wonder, like, how many people actually sort of stopped the car and repented, kind of driving past one of those. So I do think about, if I want to use Christian language in my class, how do I make it sound like it has weight, like it counts, like it's actually saying something you ought to be paying attention to, that actually has consequences, that it's not just this kind of like pious background babble that creates a nice comforting wallpaper. Again, that sort of reassures us we're on the right side and so on, but it's not really right. Doing anything, right? Then I get into my own limitations, right? I can't do that all the time. I often end up sort of focusing on, like, here's a place where I can make a really compelling connection. So, but I'd rather make that compelling connection and let it stand out within a longer stretch of teaching than kind of keep saying half-baked things that aren't really doing the work. Here's a story. 15 years ago, at least, I had a student in one of my German classes, and he was never a great German student on a grammatical level. That there wasn't a German construction he didn't kill at some point during his sequence. He graduated, and about a year later, I had a phone call suddenly one morning from Germany. And it's him. And he's so excited, he can barely put his sentences together. And he says, I had to call you. So once I've sort of calmed him down enough to get a coherent story, he tells me that morning he got on a bus and he had an hour's bus ride ahead of him. And the bus was pretty full. The next stop, a young German guy gets on, sits down in the empty seat next to him. And he notices that this German guy just seems visibly depressed. And he said, I know we learned in class that you don't talk to strangers in Germany as much as Americans do, but I figured I'm American, I can get away with it. And so I asked him how he was doing. And he told me that he'd just come from his workplace and he'd just lost his job. He'd literally just been fired and he was just coming from work and he was on his way home and he was going to have to tell his wife that he'd just lost his job and he didn't know what he was going to say. And he said, then I remembered what you said in class and my heart sank. I thought, oh my goodness, what did I say in class? Wow. what new pain have I inflicted remotely on this poor German person? He reminded me that at one point, a couple of years earlier, I'd mentioned in class the text in Deuteronomy that says, Hear, O Israel. And I'd been reading some Walter Brueggemann around that. And Brueggemann talks about how Israel's first calling was to listen before they were called to speak. That they were called to be hearing people, and that it's speaking's easier because you're in control, right? You know what's coming next, whereas hearing makes you vulnerable to what somebody else is going to say. And I said to my class, I said, has it ever occurred to you that we talk all the time about learning to speak another language? And we ask people, do you speak Spanish? Do you speak French? And yet we almost never say, can you hear Spanish? Or can you hear French? Why do we privilege speaking, right? Why do we think the only reason we might want to learn another language is because we have something to say to somebody? Might it be that one of the reasons you learn another language is because there are other people who have things to say that you need to start listening to? And that was what I said, right? And I just made this connection and it took like 5 minutes and I forgot about it. And 2 years later, I get this phone call from Germany And he said, I remembered what you said. And so I just sat and listened to him for 30 minutes. And he told his story. And at the end, he was so thankful that he'd had a chance to get it off his chest and like run through it one time and practice and so on. And I told him I would pray for him. And I had to phone you. Right? And I thought, if I've got a student who, a year after graduating, the thing that he's so excited about that he has to call his professor from Germany is not that he saw the government building or the castle or the beer festival or whatever. It's that he got to listen to an unemployed German person for 30 minutes. Then wow. Something kind of magical just happened. It's something that I don't even know if I fully understand. But it comes out of like finding this place where the faith language seems to have weight, right? It seems to connect with, it's doing work. It's not just that we read a Bible verse at the start to prove that we're Christian. But it's so I want to use, if I'm going to use scripture in class, if I'm going to use Christian language in class, I want it to be speaking in a way that has weight to what it is that we're doing right now. Not just kind of floating in the background as kind of generic commentary, but it needs to be saying something to us that we can respond to. That feels to me like it becomes more pedagogically effective than just using it like wallpaper.
Yeah. And just like as we're talking about this language, the term that stood out to me that you used was half-baked. And something that I've been thinking about a lot, especially after the course has been not just the language, well, obviously the language that we use in our class, because that's equally, or that's more ankle level, but I've thought a lot about like in our curriculum. And recently at the school that I work at, we went through like an audit process where we would go through every unit of study and rewrite or reattach a biblical worldview statement or a vision statement of some kind. And I remember in our course that we took earlier in the summer, you talked about a science course that was kind of talking about being in awe of creation through the lens of science. And I think you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you looked at what was written and you said, they won't experience that or something along those lines. But then you did encounter a teacher who or a prof who found a way to make that manifest. So my question, maybe a bit of a curveball here, what is something that we can do to make these sometimes grandiose vision statements or biblical worldview integration blurbs more practical or something that actually takes place? Like, maybe you could expand on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good example because that was me reacting to, I would often see these course statements for science courses that say students will experience awe and wonder at the complexity of God's creation. Yeah. and the idea always seemed to be somehow that this would happen automatically because it's a science course. And
yeah, that's
science,
yeah,
right? Yeah. You know? And I'm like, you know, that I've sat through lots of science courses where I didn't experience any awe and wonder at the complexity of God's creation. I experienced boredom and frustration and competitiveness and confusion and heat and cold and hunger and thirst and a strong desire to be elsewhere, but I never remember experiencing awe and wonder. So, I think that's one of some of the ways we've talked about worldview in the past, I think sometimes create this temptation that when you write these sort of department statements, you try to write this sort of timeless way in which, you know, biblical truth relates to your discipline, right? So like science is about awe and wonder, right? But of course that does nothing for your students' experience of learning. So the next important step to me is to take, it's a good move. It's the imagination piece. Okay, awe and wonder. Let's say we want to go there, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the next step is you've got to think about how am I going to create a set of behaviors and experiences for my students that are actually that I can point that if we were to stop at some point in midstream and say, okay, what we're doing right now, is this connected to what I said on the syllabus about awe and wonder? Is that what we're doing? That I could plausibly make that connection, that I could be held accountable. I think using Christian language creates a kind of an accountability for a follow through. And then to think about how the environment of your classroom can support the kind of interactions you're going for. So, you know, the example you were fishing for there was a colleague of mine in chemistry who starts his chemistry lecture by darkening the lecture theater, putting a sign on the door saying, please enter in silence, setting some quiet music playing in the background, and then he shows high-resolution digital photographs of individual snowflakes that are quite stunning. that just rotates slowly on the screen. And I think there's a fighting chance that his students experience some wonder at the start of their science class. And it didn't actually cost him a whole lot of time and effort. It was just reshaping the space a little bit. It took 3 minutes out of his class, the 3 minutes that are usually dead when nothing's happening.
Yes.
He didn't need any special equipment, you know, it was just, okay, so if I want my students to experience wonder, then I've got to think about what kinds of learning experiences might actually lead to wonder, right? I mean, in a sense, it's a really simple step. It's like, what might this actually look like?
Yeah. And there's that element too of, like, I'm thinking, because we're talking sort of nuts and bolts of creating conducive space for that to happen. You can attempt to manufacture awe and wonder. And I'm thinking almost in, like, I'm a musician as well. And in worship context, like you can manufacture emotional response, right? This is a very delicate thing you're talking about of the recipe just right, the conditions just right, that you used the phrase a fighting chance that a student would have that encounter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's even better than conducive invitational.
Yeah.
I like that you use the term accountability as well, because we, not to just say that we've done it, but to know that we are accomplishing what we're setting out to do. Mm-hmm. And it's not in a sense that, because I remember also in reading some of your work, you've talked about some people being weird, where it's almost like you stop the class and say, excuse me, now we will experience the awe and wonder and complexity of God's creation. Everyone stop what you're doing. We're going to do this now.
Here's the Christian bit.
Here's the Christian bit. And it's not like that. So I appreciate that it does take a bit more of a holistic approach, which but yet it's still accountable and ankle level. So it's a beautiful thing.
And I think you also have to think in terms of longer timescales. Like, it's not something that you kind of get done in 10 minutes in one impressive flash, right? It's something where you're going to be building up patterns over a semester and inviting students into a way of thinking about things. So I really started thinking about this a lot a decade ago when I was teaching a German class on 20th century German lit. And I worked a lot at building up patterns through the semester to try to get students to start thinking about reading using Christian virtue language. So what does it mean to do justice to a text? How do you know when you've done justice to what the author was trying to say rather than just imposed your own prejudice on it? How do you read with humility? How do you avoid just deciding on by page five that the author's really stupid and has the wrong politics? How do you read patiently, giving it time to unfold and waiting to see what's there? How do you charitably assume the best for as long as possible rather than deciding at the outset that it's going to be boring or you're going to disagree with it or whatever? So it was fascinating to me watching students wrestle with that over a period of 3 months during a semester course, and seeing it gradually take hold in their own ways of talking about their reading processes and seeing them discover things about their own reading processes. So it wasn't like I announced it in the first week and we've done it now, or now we know what the Christian answer is. It was something we had to figure out lots of ways of living into and keep coming back to and keep having conversations about, are we doing this yet, right? Are we getting plausibly anywhere near what this language seems to be asking us to do? But it was very rich once we got there and was quite transformative for a lot of students in the end. But it takes time to unfold. So I think one of my other worries about current educational culture is a lot of the ways in which we're encouraged to break everything down into small achievable objectives I think it sometimes steers our attention away from those kind of longer term rhythms.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful example that you gave, especially in like the very political, polarized world that we live in. The ability to read with humility is it's a good skill to have. Now, another curveball here, but maybe you could talk a little bit about What If Learning. That's the name of your website that has like these bite-sized, well-thought-out lessons or. I'm not sure how else you'd describe them, but these lessons that are well thought out with faith integration in the way that you were talking about, in a more imaginative sense, in a more holistic sense. And I'm curious, just in response to how you said that there are these long-term achievements, I'm wondering if someone, like let's say someone who hasn't looked too closely at this, they come and they listen to this episode, they look at What If Learning, and they just see a bunch of bite-sized objectives. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, what could you maybe say to someone who would ask that question?
What we were trying to do with What If Learning was we sort of had this feeling that sometimes people who were trying to help Christian teachers to teach better, what you often got was like a 40-minute talk on how you needed a Christian worldview, and then you were supposed to go away and apply it somehow. And we wanted to start from the ground up and design something that really started with very close-to-the-ground examples. So we built the website around 100 short examples. Now, we were also going for like minimal initial engagement. So we wanted the kind of example you could read in 5 minutes because teachers are really, really busy. And I don't think the faith and teaching connection can work if the message is always, well, if you go get a master's degree and read these five books and go to these three conferences, then maybe you can be a Christian teacher. So we just wanted to provide an entry point. So that's why they're really bite-sized sort of small entry points. Now, what we then tried to do in the website, and the metrics suggested we were having some success compared to how websites usually work, is every example is heavily cross-linked to other examples. So we keep trying to tempt you to go look at another one and to notice the connections between this one and this one. And so we were trying to provide a worm on a hook to try to tease people into a process of thinking about this. So they were really just intended as thought starters to go away. And we were also, I think we also just had this very concrete sense that, you know, if all we can achieve with someone is they come and find one example they like and go use it, then hallelujah, right? That's still better than nothing, right? It's not the destination yet, but it's a starting point. So.
Yeah, and I think that goes much in line with what you were saying earlier about how you, like, we kind of started this interview and you said, I can't talk about this stuff without giving examples. So here's this website with just loads of examples, which is wonderful.
And now, we followed that up, I'll just mention as well, we followed that up with whatiflearning.com. We followed that up with teachfastly.com. So for science teachers and Bible teachers specifically, there's another couple hundred examples on there.
That's wonderful. And seeing these examples, I appreciate them so much. And your latest project, Digital Life Together, kind of dives into some of these, well, at least looking at what the tech world is doing to our Christian schools now, and then what are we doing about it, or what are we supposed to do about it? And as someone, like the school that I work at is a one-to-one school, so everyone in grade 6, 7, 8 has a device that they're working with, and is quite tech savvy. But I'm curious as to your thoughts on your book, because I think a lot of the vision that I encounter when it comes to tech in schools is because it's the cool new educational thing to do. Mm-hmm. So how about you tell us a little bit more about Digital Life Together, especially with our online learning possibilities and hybridity being the new normal in this pandemic?
Yeah, well, part of what sparked that project was about 8 or 9 years ago, talking to a Christian school that was moving strongly in that direction. And it was a school that was very articulate about its Christian worldview and its Christian approach to curriculum and so on. And I just raised the question that, as I said, a lot of the language that's in your documents about what's Christian about your curriculum describes your old curriculum. It describes what was happening when you were using textbooks rather than having students research online. And if Wikipedia is now the curriculum, right, or the internet is now the curriculum, then you don't control the curriculum. You need to start thinking about what's Christian about the pedagogy and the way you're going to organize learning using digital devices. And what I found at that point was that the response wasn't very articulate. And there seemed to me to be a real danger that the technologies of learning are changing faster than our ability to talk about what it is we're doing. And we've got a lot of Christian language around education that just needs revisiting in light of the way that learning's changing. So we secured some grant funding and we did a deep dive into 5 schools that were doing one-to-one programs, working with laptops, iPads, internet, etc. And we spent 3 years gathering and analyzing data, doing what's called a mixed methods project, which is an attempt to take a really deep dive into what's happening from multiple angles. So we did surveys of everybody in the school community multiple times, We did 36 hours of focus groups with teachers, administrators, students, parents. We did 6 longitudinal case studies of individual teachers who were said to be good at it to find out what they were doing in the classroom. We visited 75 random classes and observed and coded what was happening in the classroom. And I have 28,000 school documents on my hard drive covering a 10-year period in the life of the school, sort of everything from meeting minutes to training PowerPoint slides to, you know, and so on. So out of that, we tried to build up a picture of what was actually changing in a Christian school that was using digital technology. And there's no way I can summarize the book in 3 or 4 minutes because we covered a lot of different areas. What we did look at was a lot of the different ways in which the school was trying to articulate the connection between faith and learning with technology, and tried to look at how successful that was being. So one of the ways the school had of talking about technology was that, well, laptops help us fulfill our mission to reach out to the world for Christ. And so we took a look at was that happening? Answer, maybe sometimes, but not as much as you say it is. There's a lot more in that section, but that's the back of a postage stamp right. version. But it was really interesting to see mission statement language interacting with what we've been talking about all along, right? How does the mission statement language interact with what's really happening when students are using devices? That the best story you tell about it is not what's actually happening day to day necessarily. We looked at discernment. The schools were really concerned about teaching students discernment about technology. So we tried to understand what teachers meant by that and how that was working. And we found that, for instance, the schools were very concerned on some of the dangers of technology, but were not talking about others.
Yeah, right.
So people were very focused on things like pornography and cyberbullying and plagiarism. But we were seeing a lot of students shopping in class, and that didn't seem to be as much of a focus. So consumerism wasn't really on people's horizon as much. And we were also seeing quite a tendency for students to use the capacity of technology to shortcut learning. So more than 2/3 of students were telling us that they were using the internet on assignments to copy answers and paste them into worksheets without understanding what the answer meant, but it looked like the right answer, and you get a good grade for it if it's the right answer, right? But you didn't even know what it meant because you copied it and pasted it from somewhere. So these ways in which we can use technology to look like we're learning, but actually shortcut the process because of the facility it gives us to search for things, to copy, to paste, to shortcut in various ways, to skim. So we looked into some of that. We looked into questions of formation, relationships, community, what it was doing to the nature of community and how people interact with each other, including parents interacting with teachers. We saw enormous stresses on teachers. Teachers were talking about parents emailing them at 10 o'clock at night and expecting something to have been done about it the next morning, and how technology was taking away the boundary between being at work and being at home. So there was never a time when you were not a teacher. In fact, teachers were even telling us stories about parents like sending an email at 3 o'clock to say that they would pick their daughter up at 3:05. And you know, the teachers in class teaching math, like somehow they're supposed to be reading their email at the same time as teaching. So the schools we looked at had some areas to grow in terms of managing the information flow so that it wasn't overwhelming for everyone and everyone wasn't left scurrying and just trying to be heroic and answer all the messages because everybody else must be keeping up, right? So that there were communal conversations that I think needed to happen about setting boundaries and deciding what kind of availability is reasonable for teachers, students, and parents. And I'm already forgetting sections, but these are some of the kinds of things we were looking into. We were trying to figure out how is this changing the fabric of what goes on in the school, and how is the school talking about this in Christian ways, and how is it actually working out? Do the behaviors match up with the language? Yeah.
And I love how, like, earlier you talked about a lot of the idea, well, what if we started with a list of Christian practices instead of starting with a worldview? And I think that that connection with what we do with tech could have some interesting effects instead of just maybe assuming that laptops are helping us fulfill our mission or fulfill our Christian worldview.
Yeah, and sometimes some really simple switches can be quite profound. So I was teaching an online course a couple of weeks ago on digital technology, and we had 40 participants from around the world. We have 14 time zones. the people in Uganda and Kenya and Taiwan and Australia and so on. And one of the things that I think we need to wrestle with technology is the tendency of technology to want to speed us up, to give us ways of managing more tasks, fitting more things into our calendar, because it gives us all of these sophisticated tools for managing more and more information. And so it creates the illusion that we can fit more and more stuff into our
efficiency
lives.
Efficiency being the value.
And so what, exactly. And often that actually counts against learning because it just turns it into task management rather than thinking. And, so one of the things we did during this course was it's funny, I've done this before in courses, but I still hesitated because it's a little weird in a for what people might expect from a graduate education theory course on digital technology. But there's an electronic soundscape musician in Iran called Poria Hatami, and he makes these kind of very gentle ambient soundscapes. And I've been following him for a number of years. And there's a video been made to go with one of his pieces. And the video is just called Snail. So if you search on YouTube for Snail by Poria, P-O-R-Y-A, Hatami, H-A-T-A-M-I. And it's 7.5 minutes long. And the video does nothing but show you a snail moving across a rock at snail speed. Very high resolution, close up. It's beautifully shot. And it also shows you a little bit of the world from a snail's eye point of view as it moves across this rock. And we just asked people to watch it. And I gave them a challenge. I said, right, your challenge for today is to watch the whole of this video attentively. And it was fascinating to me on the discussion board afterwards how many people were saying, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. It was like, I wanted to fast forward it to find out what was happening. I wanted to get back to doing the shopping, right? I was, but also how many people talked about how liberating it was to be given permission to slow down and see something in creation, to see a creature. I was struck by how many people used the phrase, I felt like I could breathe. And that, I just thought, we really got to the point where it's kind of revolutionary and almost impossible to achieve to ask professional educators to pay attention to one thing for 7.5 minutes, right? This is not, it's not like we went and joined the monastery and did, you know, all-night vigil or something. This is like 7.5 minutes, and it's a beautifully shot video, right? But it was still just difficult, and it created friction for people. So I do think there's potential to use online learning, not just as a way of multiplying tasks, but we've got all the media at our disposal, you know, videos that gifted people have made, music that people have made, and so on, that we can use to create learning experiences that get learners to reflect on the nature of the formation that's taking place as they work with technology and start to see other possibilities. One of the other teachers in that course in Indonesia said that their school had actually adopted a policy where they asked their teachers when they were teaching online to have no more than 50% of the activities actually be using a computer. The rest of the learning activities had to actually send students to interact with their family or out into outside or, you know, do something that wasn't computer based. So again, I think there are ways of bending, even if we have to teach online, there are ways of not just going with the flow and just making this like a long checklist of stuff I have to complete in the online portal.
Yeah. This conversation, talking about digital life and all of that is hyper current, and we might even say it's extremely relevant for today. And one of the things I've so appreciated about your thoughtful work, David, is being relevant for 21st century classrooms and education, and yet you draw deeply from historical examples. Christian educators, methods, different eras, times and places. I'm a history educator, teach history in high school. And one of the things that jumped out, even just the example you were using, right? So Digital Life Together is playing a little bit off of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, right? And the Life Together. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, you also have done something that I caution my own students or getting them to think about and experience is as we go to other times and places is not to sort of be just to fall into sort of a mere nostalgia for, oh, if we could only just roll back the clock and we all weren't, mm-hmm. you know, addicted to our devices, that's when it was better. Right. So maybe you could just expand for us a little bit how you've worked to sort of strike a balance between incredibly relevant material and also avoiding this this pitfall when you go to historical examples of not just being nostalgic for it. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think if you actually, I think one thing about history is if you actually go do the history properly, you always find that things weren't as beautiful exactly. as you think they were. The world's always been messed up, basically, and yep. it's kind of, you know, all your heroes have feet of clay. So I think sometimes the kind of breathless popular history you sometimes get of, like, you know, heroes of the faith and so on is a bit dishonest in terms of, you know, how things actually work. I think part of it's just bearing that in mind that, you know, that there wasn't a golden age when everybody knew how to be Christian. It's sort of fascinating. You just go back and read examples of things like there's a fascinating statute on the books of the University of Paris from, I think it was the 1300s, you know, back in the Christian Middle Ages when everything hung together. And there was actually an explicit regulation in the university prohibiting students from throwing stones at the lecturers during lectures, with a second rule added to it that explicitly prohibited them from hiring their friends or servants to throw the stones on their behalf to evade the first rule, right? So imagine a school in which you have to put that rule on the books, right? So, you know, you not only have to tell them that throwing stones is a bad idea, but you're not allowed to get around it by hiring other people. You know, and it's the same, you know, you read some descriptions of you know, 19th century sermons with people heckling the pastor and so on. So, yeah, it just, we do romanticize the past. But what I think the past can give us is people who are not us. So I think imagination cuts both ways. Imagination creates the possibility of me imagining that things could be different from the way they are. And my imagination is also what tells me that the way things are now is normal. Mm-hmm. I walk around, I have a picture of how the world works, right? You know, I drive up to a stop sign, I stop, I expect other people to stop. I've got a whole picture in my head of how that's supposed to work. I wouldn't be able to navigate if I didn't have one. And that also means I've got a picture of how schools are supposed to work and how classrooms are supposed to work and what teaching is yes. and so on. And a lot of that is not deeply thought through. It's not stuff that I consciously adopted. It's just because I went to school. It's because I grew up in Britain and work in the US. It's because I've seen other people do stuff and I've had it done to me. So a lot of it's not terribly interrogated. So I think if you're paying attention, one of the things that can happen when you go back to significant Christian thinkers in other centuries who've wrestled with these questions, is if you can get past trying to make them exactly the same as you, and sort of not try to somehow use people in the past as just a way of making you right, but actually sort of say, how did they think about this in a way that's different from the way I think about it? And is there any of that that's actually still might be a good provocation for me to think about? You know, I mean, maybe some of it's best left in the 14th century, wherever it was, yeah. right? It's, you know, every major Christian thinker thought at least a few things that were really stupid, and that's going to continue to be the case, right? With historical hindsight, not all of their ideas.
Don't get to know which bits will be viewed as stupid in the future. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. No, we're going to be the first generation that's right about everything. That sometimes feels like that's what we're trying to do. Is there anything here that's a really good provocation that if I actually spent enough time to understand why they thought about it that way, which takes a bit of work, right? And then would it give me a fresh way of running back at my own classroom that opens up some possibilities for me?
Love it. That's so good.
Well, David, thank you so much for sharing with us. And I know Dave and myself have been deeply shaped by a lot of the stuff that you do, and really appreciated both the Shaping Christian Learning Conference and our course at Regent College. So thank you for that. But for our audience that may not be as well acquainted with your projects and what it is that you're doing, how can our listeners dive deeper into your work and that of the Kairos Institute? Maybe you could share that with us.
Yeah, probably the two simplest places to go would be the Kairos Institute website is just pedagogy.net. You'll find links there to some of the other things that we've mentioned, like whatiflearning.com and teachfastly.com and Digital Life Together. We have a podcast as well, the Faith in Teaching podcast. You can find that on that website. So there's a lot of stuff that's clustered on the Kairos Institute website. It's part of the Calvin University website, but if you just go directly to pedagogy.net, you'll get straight to it. And the other place, I've just been working on this the last 8 months or so. I've got a personal website at onchristianteaching.com, and that's where I'm slowly uploading all the stuff that I've written around this. It's not all there yet, but I'm slowly uploading pieces. And so when I do, blog posts or articles yes. or papers or whatever, I'm uploading them there. So if you need more Smith, that's the other place to go. So
wonderful. All right. David Smith, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. To the listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode of Not Many of You Should Become Teachers, make sure you hit the subscribe button on the podcast listener that you're using. If you give us a good rating, that helps us reach a bit of a broader audience. But if you're looking for more, be sure to visit our website at notmanyofyou.com. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.